Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. This is the podcast with the unpopular opinion that progressive centre-left politics has a lot to offer the modern world. Social media has changed the way we talk to each other, changed the way we read, the way we work, changed the way we consume news, music, sport, television and art. It has even changed the way we think. So what does this mean for politics and how parties, campaigns and activists communicate with voters and how voters communicate with politicians? I'm Progress Deputy Editor Connor Pope, and I'm going to be discussing that with Progress Director Richard Angel, and journalist, Director of Political Human, and host of the Zeitgeist Tapes podcast, Emma Burnell. Emma, can we start from the very basics of this? What do we mean by new communications and what kind of new political communications have we seen in the past few years?
Well, I mean, what people usually mean is new media. So much more focus on online, much more focus on sort of grassroots driven online rather than the sort of very top down managed communication that was sort of the thing for about sort of the last 20 years. Everyone knowing exactly when to smile when your pager goes off and that sort of thing. So what you've got is a lot more focus, and Labour the party, but also the organisations around the Labour Party have come on in leaps and bounds. I mean, between 2015 and 2017, the way that they changed how they did online was extraordinary.
Because it felt like in 2015, the Tories were miles ahead of Labour, particularly on stuff like Facebook. And then by 2017, it almost seemed like a completely different game. Was that so much how the parties were using it, or was that also changes in the way that Facebook worked?
Probably a bit of both. Facebook is really opaque. It's almost impossible to tell what works on Facebook properly. Yeah, you have to beta test everything over and over again. And they're constantly changing the algorithm. There are changes they tell you about and there are changes they don't tell you about. So it's really, really hard. But yeah, I think it was a combination of much more organic sharing in 2017. We had a more excited base and they were sharing things that nobody knew were even an issue. I mean, ivory trading was like one of the biggest issues in the 2017 election. Did you know that? Like, it's just bizarre. But that was the sort of thing that people saw their aunt posting on Facebook. And, you know, completely organic, very, very driven by the campaign groups, and just completely different from what we thought the air was, in terms of traditional media.
What do you think is the most important platform these days? Is it Facebook? Is it email lists or is it?
It is absolutely not email lists. Nobody. When did you last open a campaigning email from anybody? I mean, obviously, I read my progress email every day.
Yeah, of course. Please sign up.
But yeah, I would say it's Facebook. People in politics think it's Twitter because that's where people in politics talk past each other. But actually, Facebook is where your punters are. And that's where getting something, as I say, organically shared on Facebook is worth its weight in gold.
And so email is just kind of that felt like...
Email is like leaflets.
Really?
We do it because we think we have to do it. But I mean, an email is literally the electronic equivalent of leaflet drops.
But leaflet drops do work. Like, the Lib Dems use them for a reason. They are a way of getting information out.
They're not a way of getting information out. What they are is a way of being visible in the community. So they work for that, but nobody reads them. You don't put information on a leaflet that you actually want people to know.
That's
what you want.
A good leaflet you can read without reading.
Well, yes.
I always think you've got between the door and the bin to read a leaflet.
You've got between the door and the recycling.
Yeah, but, of course.
Of course. I didn't run Sierra for 3 years for nothing. But what they are is a way of saying, we are in your community and we care about you week in, week out, rather than just at election time.
Gosh, our members must really think we love them. Because we do, listeners, because we do.
Richard, I was going to ask you, what do you think this means for the old school campaigning techniques that we all kind of know so well? You know, door knocking, billboard posters and media coverage in newspapers and television bulletins. Are they all obsolete or do they still...
I think they're not
role.
Obsolete, but what they don't have is the monopoly they once had in our politics. I think that's the key bit. The one thing I would say that's different to what Emma was saying is that what is happening with the new media and this emergence of new sites to propagate news is the absence of journalism and journalists, is that it is being done that because we all have read a newspaper and watched the news, we therefore know how to be a journalist, right? In the same way that I once went to school, so I'm totally qualified to be a teacher and like nothing more could annoy my teacher friends. And there is actually a skill in being a journalist. And often there is, I was having lunch with a journalist today, is like, you know, the integrity that they feel in their profession, like the fact that they have professional standards, the fact that joining the National Union of Journalists is a thing of both quality as well as status by your form of job, that is essentially being undermined. And what sometimes the role of a journalist is to do is to take what different opinions are having, and essentially what you have inserted is the activist instead of the journalist. And there is a reason for that. And you know, on Labour lists, sometimes my favourite columns are by Luke Akehurst. He's not a journalist, not pretending to be. He has a really strong opinion that he delivers really well. And there's a role for that. But equally, we don't want that to be the new monopoly in our politics.
No, I mean, I think that there are two different things there. So what you've got is campaigning, which is about activists and that kind of communication. And then political journalism, which I mean, as someone who's literally finishing my MA in journalism, I completely agree with you about the value of doing it properly and doing it right. And it is a different skill. And one of the things that I've found in terms of my own writing is that I'm moving from opinion writing, which is a perfectly valid form of journalism, but it's not the same as analysis, which is what I prefer to do now. So rather than saying, I think it's really important that everyone should vote Labour, and here's the 5 reasons why, which is what I've been doing for the last 10 years or so.
Very well, I must say.
Well, thank
always
you.
Always good pieces.
We don't always agree, but we always enjoy it.
Exactly, yeah. I'd like to go back to that, Emma.
I know, wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't that be a nice politics to have? Carry on.
Yeah, I remember when you and I were so different. But I think there is a role for journalism in particular that isn't activist, but is kind of like, look, I've been in and around Westminster for 15 years. I know kind of how the currents work. Here's where I think this is happening and why, which is a different thing from saying this is what should happen. And I think there's been too much conflation of journalists whose job it is to say, here is why this is happening, with you therefore think that is a good or a bad thing. So all of the abuse that gets aimed at, say, Nick Robinson or Laura Koonsberg, because they're reporting on what's happening rather than saying they're giving their opinion on what's happening. And people just assume that that is their opinion, is that this is the thing. For example, any reporting that happens on Labour's current rather nasty anti-Semitism crisis, what you then get is people who don't see that, feeling that any reporting of it at all is in itself inherently biased, rather than people who are saying, look, this is the big thing that people are talking about in Westminster. I think that's why it's important.
I think that's really important, because often the role of Nick Robinson or Laura Koonsberg, whatever, is to give you the complete picture. So somebody comes on the TV, John McDonnell was on the MAR programme yesterday. He had a line to give over on IRA, for example, and the international definition on anti-Semitism, but equally, those journalists will be hearing, I've told today that the Leeds office are briefing a slightly different position to John McDonnell, that they're going to have this caveat, what they're calling a free speech clause, and I call a right to be racist clause. But so for the viewer, because you want to hold powerful people to account, the role of the journalist is to say, here's the full picture. So this is what they want to tell you on the screen, but this is what they're saying in their private chats. And the role of journalists is sometimes to move between those two rooms. And what that has been perceived as by the viewer sometimes is them giving opinion when actually they're giving insight. And I think that's quite important. One of the things that's happened with it, and I had an experience of this in the last 24 hours, we had the JLM conference yesterday, and somebody, Jasmine Beckett, who stood on our NEC slate, asked a question saying, in light of Jeremy Corbyn's recent comments, do you think he needs anti-Semitism training? And John Lansman came back and said, well, we all need a bit of training every now and again, and Jeremy Corbyn's committed to lifelong learning, right? So anybody vaguely in the know about how British politics works perceived that as he thinks Jeremy Corbyn needs anti-Semitism training, right? I tweeted that, other people tweeted it, JC Report, etc. Suddenly it's like, this is fake news, all he said, and then I had 1,000 tweets last night about this. And John replied with like, oh, little old me, I was just saying, it's like, you're a pro, John. Like, you know what you're doing. They knew how it was. That was definitely how it was received by everyone in the room. But it then became this other thing. And then suddenly, for being the people who interpret the slights in politics as what they are in a power play, you're suddenly like, how dare you have taken it out of context? It's like,
what's also interesting, I think, is how these new communications and that kind of going around the interpreters changes politics as well. Because
definitely.
Actually, I remember when I used to work in the lobby in Westminster around the time that Corbyn started doing PMQs. And obviously his questions would obviously be long, slightly meandering, covering a lot of ground, but actually not being particularly incisive questions. And so all of the journalists would kind of leave afterwards and kind of go, was that very good? It didn't feel particularly incisive. But it quickly became clear that what he was actually doing was setting out a short speech that could then be cut up and posted directly to Labour supporters on Facebook so that they could see what he was saying.
Yeah, rather so the than purpose allowing of PMQs is not to hold the government to account, but to be an authoritative fora to get across a message on Facebook.
But previously, one of the other things that you would do in PMQs was have a question that could be clipped easily for the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news. And actually, it was going around the journalists saying, we don't need that. We can choose our own clips that go out to the supporters. And that was a kind of really early sign that people in his office were thinking very differently about communication.
I mean, it's very, if you've read Aisha Hazarika and Tom
Hamilton's
book on PMQs, I mean, the role of PMQs is constantly evolving. And it's it has been a very different thing. It was a different thing once the radio started going in. It became a different thing again once TV cameras went in. Every leader and every prime minister uses it differently. But yeah, you're absolutely right. What they were doing with PMQs there was thinking how best to use what Jeremy's strengths are and how to avoid what his weaknesses are. And they did that, and they've done that very successfully. That has worked very well to turn PMQs into a thing you can clip for Facebook. Whether it's what you should or shouldn't do with PMQs, that is a different question. Are we holding the government to account fully? I mean, with my own stance on Brexit, I would say no, absolutely we're not. But what it has done is engage a lot of people in a part of politics that they weren't engaged in before.
And what's interesting as well, I think, is that neither Corbyn nor Theresa May are particularly naturally adept at things like PMQs. But what the Conservatives haven't been able to do is work out how to use that to Theresa May's advantage in a way that they clearly have done for Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, because she tries to use it like she's David Cameron.
Yeah.
And she ain't David Cameron.
Like, she ain't no David Cameron.
She's really
Cameron
sad because he was rubbish. Yeah. And she's not even that good. So, like,
yeah, exactly. They're still thinking of it in the very traditional way. I mean, so they haven't moved on in that way, and they haven't found a way to make it her own. And she doesn't own it at all. And she doesn't command the House. And even before the election, when she was still riding pretty high, it still wasn't her forte.
And the Tories aren't really getting out the traps on this, are they? The problem is the alt-right are, and they are, I mean, essentially you've got fascists infiltrating UKIP and UKIP people infiltrating the Tories. That seems what's happening on the right. It's not that, you know, conservative...
A Trojan horse inside a Trojan horse.
I mean, that is literally what...
open it up and go, there's another gift inside.
Yes, exactly. Well, we kind of have that on our side, don't we? The kind of Chris Williams purists inside the Momentum pragmatists that are then infiltrating the Labour Party. So is it kind of... the mirror image of that is happening. But I suppose because the leadership of the Labour Party has been captured by that politics, that is like squat box is a more mainstream thing than some of the alt-right sites in the UK are.
Well,
at the moment.
I wouldn't say, I mean, Guido Fawkes has been mainstream for 15 years now. And I wouldn't say that there's that much difference really between Squawk Box and Guido. They're both on the extreme ends of, of their politics. They're both biased media. They're both biased media that are briefed by very senior people. I don't think there's that much difference.
Okay, that's really interesting.
I think we do need to take a very short break there, but we'll be back just after this.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm June Sarpong, and if you like the Progressive Britain podcast, then we ask you to subscribe, rate, or review it on iTunes, because that's how we reach a larger audience. And that's what progressive politics is all about.
We were talking earlier about how Facebook algorithms and things like that change the nature of how communications work so frequently now. And obviously it's, you know, less than 10 years ago that you would never have dreamed of trying to use Facebook as a real campaigning tool in politics. Is there a difficulty around this that you end up putting so much time, effort and money into a platform or a specific type of technique only for it to become obsolete? And do you think this makes it harder for grassroots campaigns to get up and going and get heard?
In many ways, it's much easier as a grassroots campaign to be heard. You just have to have the issue that catches fire. And actually, it's those voices that are much more authentic. So that's what I was saying about the ivory ban thing. I mean, nobody sat in Labour HQ and thought, what we really need to focus on is the fact that Theresa May has taken something out of the manifesto about a ban on ivory sales. Mm. But actually, people really like elephants and animals. And so somebody got hold of this, pushed it forward. You know, it was, you know, a tiny thing, and yet it traveled through Facebook like nobody's business. So the difficulty, particularly if you are like me, a communications consultant, is knowing exactly what will work and what won't, and making sure that you've got the right messages. So you just have to make sure that what you're doing is being as authentic as possible. You can't fake grassroots. It becomes very obvious. And I think one of the things that really has changed in the last sort of 15 years is people are much better at spotting that than they used to be. So I was thinking about the Swift boat stuff that happened to John Kerry in 2004. I don't know if you remember that. But he was a veteran from the Vietnam War, had two Purple Hearts. And all of a sudden, this AstroTurf, as they call sort of fake grassroots, group was set up called Swift Vote Veterans for Truth, saying that he hadn't done what he'd won his Purple Heart for. And they absolutely stormed through very young and fresh social media at that point and got that message hammered home. And now I think that wouldn't work. That kind of muddying of the waters is pretty well dispatched pretty quickly. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't all, I mean, we all curate our media to our biases. But the reason I think that would work less well now is because that bias wouldn't come into my stream. So if I were a persuadable voter, I wouldn't see that necessarily because it would be it's would be contained within the antibodies of the hard right in America.
Yeah.
I spoke to someone who, on your point about the ivory trade, I spoke to someone over the weekend who used to work at a big online campaigning platform. And they said, essentially, their entire model was pretty much based around bees because people will...
All about the bees.
People want to save the bees. And then you can do all of the kind of, you know, possibly bigger P politics stuff campaigning. But essentially, that is all subsidised by the bees. But your point there about the
Astro... Lot isn't getting any better. They're not sawing it out. Bees are still stuffed.
I thought they were getting better. I thought things were slightly better for bees now than they were a year or so ago. Haven't we banned all sorts of awful pesticides?
I have no idea. Fingers crossed. What you were saying about that...
This is not what I came here to talk about.
About the astroturfing campaigns and the kind of bad faith interpretations and things like that. Frankly, it felt like a few years ago, everyone was slightly concerned about filter bubbles on their social media. And to be honest, God,
I wish I had a filter bubble. I feel like there's too many things that I disagree with on my social media feeds these days. But how do we move past that? How do we, you know, actually create, when you are outside of, you know, are able to get into other people's filter bubbles, have actual conversations rather than ones that very much start from trenchant positions and just get worse?
I think the problem is that we don't recognise how weird we are. We spend our lives thinking about politics, talking about politics, being political, being actively involved in politics. And we have these huge, huge rows with each other and with other people. And we do this on social media. And we don't realise that 99% of the country uses Facebook to share recipes and cat pictures. And I mean, to be fair, most of my Facebook is my cat. But yeah, and that is actually, so when the politics comes into their Facebook feed, it's just a small part of it. Whereas for us, it's almost, you know, 80, 90% of it, particularly on Twitter. So I think the first thing to do is recognise how different we are in the way that we talk about, think about, focus on politics.
But this awful thing of people in politics who say, oh yeah, ugh, my friends from school, like they share this stuff, as if like that's the only real, that's the only bit that's outside the algorithm. They're the only people they haven't chosen to be friends with, because they were the people chosen for them because they went to school together. Everything since has been a kind of active choice of where they work or where they live. Since then, it's really funny. There's this kind of sneering of the like, oh, the news, that the shares that got through because my friends from school. It's like, you mean normal people?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And yeah, when you do have something about the ivory trade posted in between your auntie's holiday to Thailand and your recipe for cookies, it just feels more normal. And then you can have a conversation. Oh, I didn't know that was happening. And I think the one of the biggest things that we need to be able to do is allow people to not know stuff. Everyone is assumed to have a position straight away. And what's something that I, and you know, you've heard me bang on about this before, Connor, we call people Tory voters and then we expect them to be able to change their minds. It's like, no, she's not a Tory voter. She's someone who has once voted Tory. Yeah. And there's a difference. Stop telling.
And even if they vote Tory 4 or 5 times, yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a Tory.
If you walk down the street and you, maybe not this street because we're in Westminster, but if you go somewhere else and you ask people to describe themselves within 10 words, very few of them will say Labour or Tory or, you know, have any sort of political descriptor in there, because that's not how most people identify themselves. So the thing to do, coming back to your point, Connor, is to talk to people in the way that they talk to themselves, rather than try and go straight in with a hard campaigning message.
I think Navarra Media have been very good at that recently. And I think they used the World Cup very effectively for that. And it was for those of us who have always recognised the role of place in our politics, you know, never wanting that to be an exclusionary thing. It's not nationalism like the SNP or the right, but recognise there is place. Seeing the Navarra Media brochurists kind of embrace football, but also the flag and some of the, you know, the three lions and some of the things that have been icons of Britishness, which normally that bit of the left has really pulled away from, what I thought was quite interesting. And I thought they did a very good service for themselves in that process, actually.
Perhaps is some of the problem here that the way that online communications work and how we are essentially, in a sense, a slave to the way that these algorithms work, is that the best way to get the most out of them is by finding who your kind of pool of potential supporters are, or supporters who might be, who range from very, who care a lot, to being quite soft. And essentially, the way that getting a message out on Facebook works is you need to get the people who are very hard supporters of you to share it to the soft ones to get them enthused. And does that essentially entrench some of the divides that we're seeing? And does it possibly explain a little bit about why both Labour and the Tories currently seem to be stuck on 40% in the polls, so that you can't reach across to the soft voters from the other side?
I think the issue we have is that there are two things that you need to do with political communication, and at the moment, they're kind of antithetical. So you need to enthuse your supporters, and Labour's really, really good at that at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I was working in Ilford North on election day, and there were tons of people that Momentum had brought there. You know, and fair play to them, you know, Wes Streeting, who's the MP there, not your natural Momentum supporter, but they knew it was their local marginal. And there were, you know, hundreds of people in those Corbyn t-shirts that looked like a Run DMC logo, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, fair play, they came out and they did their bit. And so we're very, very good at that enthusing part. But in order to do that, what we're delivering is the most hardcore of Labour messages. That then doesn't necessarily do the other job, which is the persuasion part. So the problem we've got at the moment is that we've got an awful lot of enthusing and not an awful lot of persuading. And the leadership and the party are gambling on that being enough. It may be. The Tories are useless and fading fast and have no policy, and Brexit's going to be a disaster, and they will have to own that. So it may well be enough. We shall see.
Finally, I want to talk about the kind of like the next challenge for Labour down the line, which is we seem very good at using new communication techniques at the moment to talk about radicalism and getting people enthused for that. But obviously, once you get into power, that then becomes a very different question. And I just kind of wondered what both of your thoughts are on how you carry on to communicate radicalism in power in the modern day.
Well, the traditional adage is you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Mm. And then Donald Trump campaigned on Twitter and governs on Twitter. And it's, and it's horrifying to watch, but it's kind of working for him. It's actually the most horrifying thing he can change.
We'll see in November.
we will. Well, no, I don't think it'll be as bad for him as we would like it to be. No. And he'll turn it being bad for him into it being good for him somehow. That's it, because it won't be the people that have risen up to give him a Democrat house. It'll be the Democrats have thwarted his best attempts to build a wall and make someone else pay for it or whatever, to be racist and unpleasant to people with no impunity or under the rule of law. And I think if Labour were to win, that would be a similar model that they would go with. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is not going to govern this country. He does not do detail in any way, shape or form. He does not make decisions. He backs causes. That's what he does. And he'll, in that sense, he'll be like kind of perfect chairman of the board in that position as prime minister.
So he needs to turn being prime minister into a campaigning job.
Yeah. And I think he will govern on Twitter. Like he will, they'll send out broadcast messages about things. The person who'll run the country is John McDonnell from the Treasury and a combination of Seamus Milne and Andrew Murray from the Cabinet Office. And that should really be a wake-up call for certain people. But I think that's the model they will go down. But it will end up being insufficient to the challenges of the country, the way the Trump administration is. But Trump administration thing seems to be working for him. That's what's most worrying.
I mean, it is. I don't think the blue wave is going to be a big enough blue wave in November. Whether he'll get a second term, whether he wants a second term, maybe he'll get a second term just so he can stay out of jail. But it's working for him insofar as that he's still president, but he's not able to do an awful lot with it. He hasn't built a wall. He hasn't, you know, sorted out North Korea. That seems to have gone completely wrong. So he's president, so what? At the moment is kind of like, you know, he's not getting an awful lot done. And that is the worry, isn't it? Will we get what we desperately need to get done to change the country done? I think the problem the left has is it's much, much better at the language of campaigning than it is at the language of power. And that's partly because we have an analysis that's not just about inequality of wealth, but inequality of power, which makes us very uncomfortable when we get power. We're not very good at holding that power and owning it. And we talk about wanting to give power away, but you can't give something away until you accept your ownership of it. And so I think that we need really, you know, to look very strongly at how we talk about owning power and how Labour becomes confident in that ownership of it without becoming, you know, dictatorial, which is, you know, a different thing altogether. I'm not sure we have a language for that yet. In fact, this is something I want to go and investigate and do a PhD on. So, you know, please don't invent the language of it before I can go and do that. But it is, I mean, it's a fascinating question. The Conservatives are very good at sounding like they should be in power, and Labour are very good at telling them why they shouldn't. But we're not that good when the roles are reversed.
And the danger is if you look like you're good at it when the roles are reversed, that confirms your red Tory status. And I think we should try and think of these things as a kind of custodians of power in that sense, in that we do kind of get it to give it away, and we don't seek power for our own interests. We seek it for other people's. And you know, the point of the Labour movement being founded was that if working class people are around the table, they will make better decisions. It wasn't actually, it was called the Labour Party, not the British Socialist Party, because it was not an ideological pursuit. It was about an analysis about who should have the access to power. But I was talking to somebody at a wedding the other day, and they were having a go about Dave Prentice being a governor of the Bank of England, and that meant that he was now part of the kind of bosses class and would sold out working people. I was like, literally the trade union movement campaigned to be at the top table where they're deciding what normal people's mortgage rates are. Like, because that really matters. And if it is suddenly a betrayal by taking that place, we can never possibly win. I was like, oh, you believe in a revolution. Fair point. Shouldn't be in the Labour Party. Bye. But that was what they were getting at, because that's ultimately... But you've got from that Ramsay MacDonald moment of going and heading up a cross-party government, the betrayal in the early part of the Labour Party, that we're suspicious of anybody who gets near power because they're just 2 seconds away from betraying the movement. And it's so counterintuitive, because it means you're not able to pursue it in the same way.
No, absolutely. And you know, that is the problem of the left, the dichotomy of the left, is that we don't trust anyone who has power, and yet we seek power. And also, I would like to say that you have just proved my point about how weird we are, that that's a conversation you had at a wedding.
I totally accept that. Apparently, I was a point of amusement that I was even there, that somebody as evil and right-wing as I had attended said event. So I was kind of poked and prodded like I was in a museum of this old third-way mantra that still apparently exists. Chris Mullin did an interview with Progress years ago in the Coalition, and he said Labour needs to become more confident like the Tories. They didn't even win a majority, but they're behaving like they won everything, and that Labour occasionally needs to do that. But of course, the minute you do, the betrayal sets in.
Anyway, I think we probably need to wrap up there. But Emma Bunnell, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Every week, Connor asks the political pub quiz question, which is then answered on Friday's show.
This week, my question is, which Labour leader's middle name was McIntosh?
Oh, get Googling, people, or unless you know it instinctively, get your answers in to office@progressonline.org.uk. You can tweet Connor at Connor Pope or at Progress Online. Let us know what you think the answer to the question is, and you could win a Progress mug.
Googling is definitely cheating, although there's no way that we can check. So we need to wrap up now. We've been delighted to have Emma Bunnell joining us today. Send in your questions and comments through Twitter, email, or best of all, as an iTunes review, and we'll respond to them on Friday's show, with the best iTunes comment winning a prize. Please don't forget to subscribe and rate. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Progressive Britain podcast. The music was When in the West by Blue Dot Sessions, licensed under Creative Commons. And many thanks to the brilliant Caroline Crampton, who produced this podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.